Trade war? Yeah, we're talking about that because it's still a thing. Infrastructure week? Yeah, that too, because it might be a thing. And where things stand in the great economic unwinding from this pandemic. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 29th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Ever Given is underway, as you have probably heard by now. After something a bit more than 6 days plugging up one of the key trade routes of this global economy, the giant container ship that couldn't, really, is finally headed north in the Suez Canal. Final monetary damages to global trade yet to be tallied. Shipping delays are, of course, not the only thing going on in global trade, and that is where we will begin today. Back in the before times, which is to say January last, the Trump administration was cutting a trade deal with China. You might remember that. There were hopes the trade war and associated tariffs on $500 billion worth of goods from China would soon be in the rearview mirror. Well, over the weekend, or 15 months and one change of administration later, Katherine Tai, the new U.S. trade representative, said all American tariffs are going to stay, at least for the time being. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the rest of that story.
Keeping tariffs on Chinese imports shows that the Biden White House will challenge Beijing when it needs to, says Scott Paul at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. It lobbies for Buy America policies. And he says this fits into the Biden plan of boosting domestic supply chains in several sectors.
They start with semiconductors, where there's been this global shortage, strategic minerals and batteries necessary to power a clean energy economy.
The overall Biden strategy on China is still in formation. But already the two-way trade war has cost American exporters 300,000 U.S. jobs, according to Moody's Analytics. Former trade official Amy Sellico is with the Albright Stonebridge Group, a business advisory.
The business community is trying to ensure that the Biden administration understands just how important the China market remains. Japanese businesses, European businesses are also saying the same things to their governments.
Despite keeping the tariffs in place, the Biden administration is trying to find areas where it can also cooperate with China. For instance, on climate, says Cheng Li at the Brookings Institution.
It's not a secret that Biden will invite world leaders for the climate summit next month. So I think Xi Jinping will be invited. There's a possibility that both leaders will also have a side meeting.
He says keeping the tariffs gives the U.S. bargaining leverage with China. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you've heard the show the past couple of Fridays, you probably heard me say it kind of feels like we are turning a corner with this pandemic. More people getting vaccinated, more businesses opening up. But it's a weird time too, right? People are still getting sick and dying from this virus. In some places, case counts are just going the wrong way. And that puts public health officials and policymakers in a tough spot. Case in point, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, two recent pieces of news from the Centers for Disease Control.
Item one, the CDC is extending its eviction moratorium until June 30th. Item two, the cruise industry didn't get what it wanted, and restrictions on sailing from U.S. ports will stay in place until November. Very different issues with different stakes, but both point to the fact the CDC thinks we still have a ways to go in this pandemic, says Dr. Philip Landrigan, who used to work at the CDC and now teaches at Boston College.
They have to decide which sectors of the economy absolutely have to be controlled and which can be let go. And they have to balance economics and humanitarian considerations.
And that is an exercise in risk management, says Dr. Bill Lang of World Clinic, who specializes in analyzing health risks. He says if COVID were a disease that killed almost everyone who got it, very few people would question continued restrictions.
But if it is a disease where the risk is now increasingly managed by vaccine, and also by the better treatment methods, then you can take more risks.
But that desire to take more risks had CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying this in a press conference today.
Right now, I'm scared.
She says there is reason for hope and optimism, but there are also new variants of the virus.
Just please hold on a little while longer. I so badly want to be done. I know you all so badly want to be done.
We're almost there, she said, but not quite yet. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today and along those lines, traders were like, virus? Schmirus? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tens of millions of Americans have been doing the whole work from home thing. Those of us lucky enough to be able to work from home, it should be said. It's been happening for more than a year now. And for some not small portion of those people, being not in the office is the only experience of their jobs they have ever had. Last April, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reported on the challenges and just general weirdness of starting a new job from home during this pandemic. Here with an update.
When Tristan Hall started a new job as a software engineer in North Carolina last year at the beginning of the pandemic, the whole video thing was kind of fresh. He would still get dressed up for meetings in work clothes, even shoes. Now,
it's like no shorts and definitely no socks.
While he doesn't exactly feel like the new guy anymore, he's never been to an office or seen any of his coworkers beyond the little window of the video chat. Though he says that little window can reveal a lot.
My daughter jumps on some meeting, or like she'll jump in my lap and sit on me sometimes. She can't do that when I'm in an office, you know?
Still, he's excited and maybe a little nervous about the prospect of finally meeting folks in person as his company plans to reopen in the coming months.
I have to learn how to like become friends with people again. I don't know. Like, learn that whole high school clique thing.
Because try as companies might have, no amount of virtual happy hours, trivia, or talent shows can replace face-to-face interactions.
It's get ready to be the new kid on the block again, right?
Jill Chapman with HR services firm Insperity had been a fan of those goofy virtual events to engage new employees. But after a year of them, she says the deficiencies of video communication have become clear, and companies need to be ready to help employees fill in those gaps as offices reopen.
I think the onus is going to be on our managers to really understand their new old employees or old new employees, however you want to call it, are going to need to be reoriented.
Though some companies have just reoriented themselves. Alicia Harmon O'Meara is an executive at Edmodo, an e-learning company that used to be based in the San Francisco area.
We no longer have an office. We are not planning to go back to the office.
In the early weeks of the pandemic, O'Meara struggled to just get new hires set up with a computer. Since then, the company has brought on 16 people and streamlined the process with an automated onboarding program and a host of apps. Though the virtual lunches, still awkward.
Eating is just the weirdest. It's just the weirdest experience when you're like just staring at one person on a screen or like lots of people on a screen. I don't know if we'll ever get used to it.
But it wasn't just the awkward video calls Robert Down couldn't get used to at the job he started last year as the pandemic began. He had left a job as a nurse in Orlando for a remote gig in data analysis for a hospital until a few months ago.
In January, I finally just said, like, I got to pause that. And there's a pressing need right now. And so I left my stay-at-home 9-to-5 desk job to go back to the bedside.
Like many pandemic hires, Down had never met his coworkers at his previous job, though they did throw him a farewell dinner in person.
They thought it was important to at least say, like, we're real. We're not just people on the other side of a computer. I think maybe it would have been a little more difficult to leave when you had developed those relationships over the course of a year in person.
He's now onboarding again as a travel nurse in South Florida. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We have come at long last to what might finally be Infrastructure Week. That's with a capital I and a capital W, by the way. President Biden is set to unveil his infrastructure plan this week after a full Trumpian term of infrastructure promises without plans. Among many other things on the list, President Biden says he wants to spend 2% of GDP on science. Doesn't sound like all that much, maybe, but it is more than twice what we are spending right now. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on that.
Right now, the U.S. spends about 0.7% of its GDP on science. So what would we get if we up that to 2%?
A fair amount.
Retired Major General Bob Latif, a former Air Force researcher, says the spending boost would work out to hundreds of billions of extra dollars for
NASA, National Institutes of Health, all of the government organizations whose responsibilities really lie in the science area.
The idea is to get science spending back to where it was 50, 60 years ago, the height of NASA's Apollo missions and moon landings, and experimentation at the Department of Defense that helped lead to the creation of the Internet. James Lewis is a researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The Internet's part of your daily life. Well, that was a little DOD program that started in the early 70s, and we need to be able to do things like that again.
President Biden has specifically mentioned spending more money on super fast quantum computing, biotech, and artificial intelligence. The National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence estimates the U.S. needs to spend $32 billion over the next few years to win the AI race with China. The commission's executive director, Ili Bayraktari, says China could catch up to the U.S. very soon.
Our lead is between 18 to 24 months.
Bayraktari says President Biden's plan for science spending is a step in the right direction. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Might I recommend, should you be in need of business and economic news early of a weekday morning, the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang getting out of bed real early so you don't have to. Business news to start your day. Check it out. Coming up,
we haven't had English cheeses for over 2 months, you know.
You gotta have English cheeses, man. Come on. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 98 points today, about 0.3%, ended at 33,171, record high by the by. NASDAQ down 79 points, 0.6%, finished at 13,059. S&P 500 off 3 points, less than 0.1%, basically flat, 39.71. Yes, I did just unzip my jacket in this studio. Boeing flew up 2.3%, if you heard that, from Southwest Airlines, ordering 100 of the company's 737 MAX jets. European airplane maker Airbus was off 0.2%. Southwest Airlines gave back about 0.5% today. Oil stocks turned lower. Chevron weakened about 0.5%. Valero Energy flagged 1.7%. Occidental Petroleum down 2.7% as more COVID-19 lockdowns loom in Europe. And, oh, by the way, that ship got underway. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. $7.25 an hour times 8 hours gets you $58 for a full day's work at the current federal minimum wage. Congressional Democrats, some of them anyway, are trying to find a way to raise that pay without success as of yet. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is spending this season on work in this economy, how it got to be the thing that it is, and how it is changing. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, the host of that podcast, has part one of her story about how we got the federal minimum wage in the first place and how companies have been pushing back against it since even before it was passed.
I want to take you back to the 1930s. The country's already plunged deep into the Great Depression. Jobs are really hard to find. And a lot of the jobs that do exist have wages that are really, really low.
Here is the challenge to our democracy.
Here's President Franklin Roosevelt in his second inaugural address in 1937, talking about just how bad things are for so many people.
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day.
People were willing to say yes to anything, even if there were pitiful wages, even if they didn't give them enough to buy enough bread for their family.
This is Kate Griffith. She's chair of the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell. And she says there was a sense among many people that part of why wages were so low was because workers had no bargaining power.
Even companies that could have paid a bit more and did have some profit margins were taking advantage of the fact that you had very desperate and hungry people who were willing to work for basically nothing.
So Congress passed this law, the Fair Labor Standards Act. It created the federal minimum wage and overtime rules. In case you're wondering, back then, minimum wage started at 25 cents an hour. But when lawmakers were writing this law, Griffith says they were very careful about how they worded it because they knew plenty of companies were not going to like it.
You know, it's not convenient to be regulated and to have to pay these things.
In fact, before the federal minimum wage was passed, there'd been a handful of states that had passed minimum wage laws, laws that businesses had challenged in court. They argued the laws violated their right to freely negotiate with their workers. And for decades, the Supreme Court agreed. It struck down state minimum wage laws as unconstitutional. But in 1937, in the face of so much poverty, the court's perspective shifted. The majority came to see minimum wage laws as vital to a worker's right to freely negotiate. It gave them some bargaining power, so they didn't have to say yes to just anything. Plus, without a minimum wage, taxpayers would have to carry more of the burden for people in poverty. Basically, the court said,
there's just a decency wage that our democracy requires.
Once the Supreme Court ruled in favor of state minimum wage laws, FDR's administration worked with lawmakers to pass a federal minimum wage, and they made one thing very clear.
We're not going to let the companies find loopholes, because they will.
Griffith says lawmakers were keenly aware of the creative tactics a company might use to try to get around employment laws. Things like businesses claiming their workers were independent contractors just to avoid paying minimum wage.
They were suspicious.
And so lawmakers write the minimum wage law in this incredibly expansive and kind of weird way. They declare that every employer shall pay to each of his employees a minimum wage, and they define that word employ that's at the heart of the law like this.
To suffer or permit to work.
To suffer or permit to work. When you employ someone, you permit them to work, or at least you suffer them to work. Suffer as in tolerate.
What they meant is if a company knows work's happening, is in a position to know it's happening and it's benefiting them, they're responsible as an employer.
The definition acts like a blanket. It assumes a worker is an employee who deserves minimum wage, unless the people who hired the worker can prove otherwise. And it makes the word employment fit lots of different kinds of work arrangements, not just the kind from the 1930s, because lawmakers knew.
Every workplace would be different. They knew that when they wrote those words.
Richard Carlson's an employment law professor from South Texas College of Law, Houston.
They were being purposely vague because they knew they could never really nail down this thing that was going to continue to evolve.
But as broad and flexible as this minimum wage law was meant to be, there have been cracks in it through history. Cracks written right into the law that many Americans in all types of industries are still falling through, especially workers of color. More on that tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
I don't know if you remember this, because everything, but the last big sticking point in the Brexit negotiations was the land border between the province of Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and Ireland, which is in the European Union. Both of them, of course, on the same island. It will perhaps surprise you not at all that things aren't going smoothly with what's known as the Northern Ireland Protocol, which would, in effect, keep the British province inside the European Union. Problem is, the protocol imposes a different hard border. It's in the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and its biggest market, the rest of the UK. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
The protocol has affected food supplies. Many product lines usually shipped in from England have disappeared from supermarkets and other stores in the province. Kieran Sloan runs the Sores Deli in Belfast.
Things like cheese, we haven't had English cheeses for over 2 months, you know.
Some of his suppliers based in the British mainland balked at the paperwork and the extra cost of getting their product into Northern Ireland, now effectively an EU territory.
Two of our big main cheese suppliers have just said they're not supplying Northern Ireland anymore. So, and that's it. And a lot of our Mediterranean companies that are based in London have just stopped as well.
His supplies of meat, olives and dried herbs have also been disrupted. But garden centres in the province have been even harder hit. Under EU biosecurity rules, British soil is now banned from entering Northern Ireland. Surrounded by an old consignment of potted roses and rhododendrons, Robin Mercer of the Hillmount Garden Centre is not happy.
All these plants are coming from England. Now we cannot get them because of the new rules and regulations. Really what they're saying is any plants, any soil in it, they will not let us bring them through.
The protocol was designed to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic to avoid inflaming the large minority in the province that wants a united Ireland. Trouble is, the protocol's inflamed members of the unionist community that wants to remain British.
This has been an unmitigated disaster.
Ian Paisley Jr., lawmaker for the Democratic Unionist Party, speaking in a Zoom call to the UK Parliament.
The protocol has betrayed us and has made us feel like foreigners in our own country.
Imagine a border between Texas and the rest of the US, he says. And, says Steve Aiken, leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, imagine Canada or Mexico deciding what food Americans are going to eat.
I mean, can you imagine anybody in the United States putting up with it? Definitely not.
Unionist anxieties have been further fuelled by how some businesses are responding. Kieran Sloan of Sores Deli has increasingly turned away from Britain to suppliers in the Irish Republic in the south.
We've been buying all our Spanish meats, Italian meats, all the charcuterie, all the cheeses, all the olives. We've been bringing them up through the south, you know what I mean? And it seems to be working.
And he thinks many other Northern Ireland businesses, formerly dependent on supplies from the rest of the UK, may end up doing the same.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just me. I mean, it's going to be a lot of the companies here are going to be using that as the sort of an easier way to do things, you know.
Unionists fear that by forcing economic ties with the South, the protocol could be taking a step towards a united Ireland, and without their consent as required under the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace to the province 20 years ago after decades of sectarian violence.
I am the river lagging, the city of Belfast.
By a curious coincidence, this year sees the 100th anniversary of the creation of Northern Ireland. This song, I Am Northern Ireland, was commissioned to celebrate the centenary. But COVID has so far stifled the planned festivities, and the bitter dispute over the protocol has muted the celebrations. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, honestly, Volkswagen, try harder, will ya? So, electric vehicles are, as you know, the future, and legacy car makers are doing their darndest to keep up with all those flashy startups. So, today, Volkswagen, apparently by mistake, announced a rebranding from Volkswagen to, now wait for it, Voltswagen, V-O-L-T-S, Voltswagen. USA Today spotted it, took a screenshot of it before it was taken down. This is more, the company said, and this is a quote, than a name change. Volkswagen, see, I can't even say it, is a public declaration of the company's future forward investment in e-mobility. About which two things. Number one, okay. And number two, if one were cynical, one might say they leaked it on purpose for the buzz, you know? All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context on a Monday in which we hearken back to Kimberly's story about how close And yet how far we are from the economic unwinding of this pandemic. Any day now, President Biden's going to sign a two-month extension of the Paycheck Protection Program, those forgivable loans for mostly small businesses that are still a year plus into this thing, trying to hang on. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.